Hi there. My name's Dr. Damien Rowland. I'm a paediatric emergency medicine consultant at the Leicester Royal Infirmary, and I'm going to be chatting today with Dr. Hannah Robbins. Hannah, do you just want to introduce yourself?
I'm Hannah Robbins. I'm a GP partner at Long Lane Surgery in Colville. I've worked across the city and county in other practices in the past, and I did quite a lot of peds in my training before becoming a GP. I've also the newly appointed clinical lead for children and young people across LLR, and we're looking particularly at acute presentations and the primary care children's emergency interface.
Thanks, Hannah. So why are we talking about bronchiolitis in June? It's not the normal period where we see this disease. Well, the reason is that COVID has changed a lot of things, and it's pushed normal respiratory viruses into different seasons. We know that happens because it's happened in America, it's happened in France, and it's also happened actually quite spectacularly in Australia, where they've had huge, what is their summer demand for bronchiolitis. And there is a real worry, actually, that we will see a lot of bronchiolitis this summer rather than this winter. And so we're doing this to highlight that this condition may pop up in your GP surgery or assessment clinic or in your emergency department. So typically, Hannah, when you see a child who you think has bronchiolitis, what are the features you use to help you decide that you're going to send that child home or with safety net with the parents?
Well, I think feeding is a key thing, and a benchmark I tend to use is if a child is taking at least 50% of their normal feeds, they're not that unwell, because if they were really poorly and using all their accessory muscles for respiration, they can't stay on the bottle or the breast. So I suppose we're talking about very, very young babies. I think the other things that I've asked parents about is how they handle. Do they feel normal? Do they feel a bit floppy? I'll tend to ask about their hands and feet. Have they got cold hands or feet? And just generally then kind of the level of parental concern. But, you know, what I've done as a default in the past is if I've got any level of concern, I just say to the patient, just bring them down and I'll see them. But we're dealing with a slightly different situation now, because obviously there is this underlying risk that this child might have COVID because they've got respiratory symptoms. And the need, if you're going to separate, to assess these children, you've got to do it in a way that's safe, that doesn't put your other patients at risk. And so we're dealing with remote consulting, and this is bringing extra challenges because I can't just eyeball the child in the same way.
Yeah, I mean, it really has kind of flipped a lot of stuff over. Now, one of the things that does make it a little simpler, either remote or face-to-face, is there are some things about bronchiolitis which become really self-evident early on, even via kind of a video consult or just listening to a parent. If you can really hear the child struggling to breathe, the parents feel that they've got, they're not taking any feeds at all, and they're describing a dusky, lifeless child, that makes it really easy that child needs a kind of ongoing care. The flip side being all the things that you've described about feeding well. Personally, in my practice, that children, especially below the age of 6 months, are so dependent on their respiratory status to feed. The feeding is the guide, as you've explained. And if they can, whatever their respiratory rate is really, as long as they can feed, that shows that they've probably got a good status quo for the moment. The other things that kind of pop up the woodwork, that we do have a big ex-prem cohort. I think if you're less than 6 weeks and you've already ex-prem, however you're doing, that child needs really careful monitoring because they can fall off their perch really easily. The converse, though, it's if you're an ex-prem, but you've now got to kind of a year and that you've grown out of things, so you're not in oxygen, you've not had loads of presentation with respiratory illness, that probably becomes less relevant. So what causes you a bit of challenge, Hannah, in this equivalent cohort? This group of people who don't clearly have a high risk factor, but parents are a bit worried about them.
Yeah, I mean, I will often ask about family history, so you get an idea of whether the parents are upskilled, because you do tend to see bronchiolitis and viral wheeze runs in families. So I'll tend to ask if parents have dealt with that before, and that gives me, I suppose, a level of assurance about how much responsibility I can hand back to the parents. I'll ask about how long it's been going on for, because my experience of bronchiolitis is it tends to worsen and peak at about 7 days, and then it tends to ease up, and by day 12, they're a lot better. So I guess if that child is already sounding really quite unwell and they're on day three, that gives me an added level of concern. Whereas if they've been poorly for 7 days, I can confidently say to the parents, actually, you're probably over the worst now. So those are other things I tend to look for in terms of reassuring myself and the parents that this child doesn't need further care.
And I think that trajectory is absolutely vital. And you're right, it has this curve which slowly gets worse and then gets better again. I think the key thing is a safety net. It doesn't necessarily mean because they're at day three or four that they need to come into hospital if they're bad. But if you alluded to it, it's telling the parents that you might not be over the worst of it yet. And at least that gives them something to hang their hat on in the next 12 to 24 hours. Because if the child starts getting better then, actually they're quite relieved because it probably is over the worst, but it means that they will bring them back if they've got concerns.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of safety netting with the parents, again, you know, parents need simple instructions, especially if they're dealing with a poorly baby who's keeping them up overnight, because those parents are not only worried, they're also sleep deprived. So the simple things I tend to look at are feeding and saying to the parents, if they feed less than 50% of normal over a period of 12 hours, you need to be getting further medical advice. And the other thing is wet nappies. So again, we're talking about, I suppose, the younger cohort, the children under the age of three and a half. And I'll say if this child has no wet nappies over the course of 12 hours, that's another indicator they're not getting enough fluids in and we need to know about it. Are those the sort of benchmarks we should be looking at, David? Is there any way I can give a more robust safety netting approach?
I think the big thing is the British public are almost obsessed with urine and bowel output, even if they don't talk about it. And we all, as parents, when you change a nappy in a child, you weigh it in your hands and you get a really good sense over time of what a normally wet nappy is. And that's what I tell to parents all the time. If you can pick up a nappy and chuck it across the room and it hits the wall with a thud, that's enough fluid in it. If it waves around in the wind, that means that very little urine is being produced. And so if you're going 12 hours with no urine production in an infant, that's something to be concerned about. And actually, sometimes I think parents struggle a bit, especially if you're breastfeeding, with knowing how much the child has taken, but you all know how much your child's weighing. And I think that's a really good yardstick that is objective for parents to have.
That's really helpful. I think the other thing that I learned when I did paediatrics, and I know not all GPs have had the luxury of doing a paediatric placement, but what I learned is that letting parents know that they can come back if they're worried is so reassuring that actually it filters out some of those presentations that are driven purely by anxiety. So we used to give open access to parents when we discharged them from the admissions unit. And I think, you know, reassuring parents and saying, if you're worried for any reason, you know your baby best, please come back to us, and telling them sort of how to access care, whether that's GP surgery during opening hours or 111 if it's outside hours, or if you've got a child who actually is floppy and you're really worried, you know, that might be 999. I think just signposting them in that way can be helpful. But again, I don't know what your thoughts about that are, Damien, and how impactful that is.
Yeah, so there are loads of studies which show there's a massive mismatch between what the parent wants to happen of the consultation and what the healthcare professional does. And actually, a lot of the time, the healthcare professional thinks that the parents are demanding treatment or admission. All they want to do is be heard. And I think hearing a patient and listening to the family and saying, actually, well, at this moment in time, they're fine, but you're always welcome to call back, come back, or that the situation might change. That just diffuses the situation instantly, in my opinion.
Yeah, oh, that's really helpful.
So just a few tiny things to finish off with. One of the problems I see a lot, and this happens in our emergency department when I'm talking to our junior doctors about sending patients home, is what is written down or is described in terms of objective observation, heart rate, respiratory rate, but also what you want to do with the child. And there's often a difference between the child on paper might look quite unwell, but to you is beaming and smiling. So write down that the child is beaming and smiling so that helps you support your decision to discharge them. And then the other way around is the child's observations might be quite completely fine, but you want to admit them for a specific reason that isn't clearly defined in the vital signs. And I think that needs to be described as well, because that helps with communication. I don't know what your thoughts were on that, Hannah.
Yes, I think you're right. I mean, a lot of this is around gut feeling, isn't it? And trusting yourself as a clinician, but also trusting the parents and their gut feelings. I think it'd be really helpful to have some criteria, which I know won't cover everything, but you know, those warning signs to look out for, Damien.
Yeah, and I think that comes into what I call the bias train is when people make a decision. As soon as the child walks in, you've decided what they've got. You do some perfunctory examination, which confirms that bias. And then you start on this dreadful diagnostic momentum pathway leading to premature closure. So, what are the things that we miss? Every year, there will be two or three cardiac cases in amongst the bronchiolitis that we see. You should be in the habit of every child, especially if they're less than 6 weeks, of feeling for femoral pulses. I know it can be a bit of a bind in a busy clinic, but that is quite an important thing if you're seeing the child face to face. Clearly, very difficult if you're remote. And also, if you're listening to the chest, do listen to the heart. It's really easy just to get into the habit of going to both sides without quickly chatting the heart. Takes less than 1 to 2 seconds, but there will be a cardiac disease somewhere out there, and that's a good way of stopping it happening.
So this is for the patients that we're seeing face to face rather than remotely. And there will be
Yeah.
some in this cohort, I guess, whose duration of illness and they may have had a PCR test, we may feel that we can confidently bring them down to see them. It's those patients or maybe those whose respiratory symptoms are not resolving over the time scales we'd expect. I guess these are the cohorts we're looking at. Is that right, Damien?
Yeah, and it's difficult. Let's say you've got a parent over the phone who's been worried about a particular respiratory symptoms rumbling on for weeks. Bronchiolitis is a really difficult disease. It gives you a cough 4 weeks afterwards, and it's often very frustrating for parents, especially if it means that you're not sleeping very well or you need to take time off work. It causes a great deal of stress, and it's very difficult to deal with. The big thing for me is whether that child's thriving. And actually, most parents do know, especially at these ages between 6 weeks and 6 months, you grow rapidly. If you are growing rapidly, it's really unlikely that there's some serious pathology, whether that's respiratory or cardiac. And if the parents are having to buy new clothes, if the child's clearly gaining weight, these are all really good signs. The red flags are when the parent goes, "Well, I've not had to buy any new clothes recently," or that on the last couple of weight gains with the health visitor or the ones that I've just done, they've put on no weight. That's a red flag.
So what I'm hearing from you, Damien, then is as well as those initial questions about feeding, wet nappies, how they're handling the colour, and establishing the timescale, we need to be asking about overall growth and development, and have you got any concerns about weight gain?
Yeah, especially if we go to more virtual consultations, and you're not able to physically see the child in front of you. I think that's really important.
Okay, great.
Well, fantastic. I think that was a really useful discussion with some really nice little tips. Is there anything else that you think that we need to discuss that we've not done already?
I think that's really helpful, actually. I feel I've got a much clearer framework around the questions I'm going to ask and the advice I'm going to give to parents. So that's been really useful.
Yeah, fantastic. As moving forward, we don't know when or if the RSV epidemic is going to hit this summer, but I hope that that provides a useful framework for people to start thinking about this condition. As always, there's going to be a load of resources out there online, some of which will be pushed through by the CCG and the Leicester Royal Infirmary. So please do look out for those.
Thanks,
Thanks for your
Damien.
time, Anna.